Are you ready to change your tomorrow and start feeling good again? You're in the right place. Grab your coffee and together, let's start doing wellness differently. I'm Heather Young, a certified personal trainer.
And I'm Jennifer Klutz, a registered dietitian nutritionist. Join us for conversations that will inspire you to ask better questions, remove the overwhelm, and discover what you can do to change your health now.
Welcome to the Critical Conversations Podcast. So, Jennifer, the first place we have to start this conversation is at the beginning, with just a quick refresher for anyone who hasn't thought about protein in a long time, or the beginning of understanding for anyone who's never had it explained to them. What is protein?
So, protein is one of the three main macronutrients we need to have energy for our bodies to thrive. The other two are fats and carbohydrates. Protein itself is made up of what's called amino acids. And amino acids are the building blocks for basically a ton of stuff in our body. So they're essential. Like, you die without amino acids. Within that, amino acids are kind of fun because they can, within our body, we are either breaking them down or we're reassembling them based on what we need from our body. Like, so muscle building versus muscle tear down, right?
So I've heard you explain to me that a fun way to think about amino acids is like Legos.
Yes. They build on each other. Or
it's
they
a
stack.
Pretty cool visual for how all the amino acids can fit together.
And the thing within this that is already a part of like the noisy part, even with just the basic understanding of protein, is that there's a lot of articles or even people saying that protein will turn into fat. And this is not true. The level of protein that the average person would have to consume for that phenomenon to happen, it's so excessively high, it's not going to happen. Unlike if you overate fat, that does actually turn into fat.
Good to know.
So that's one of the little noisy parts. If someone's looking at you and saying, don't overeat protein, it converts into fat, that is not true. The odds of that happening and you not utilizing the amino acids in that protein for all the functions in your body, very, very unlikely happening.
Okay, so once you have this basic idea of what protein is, the next question is the why. I feel like I'm turning into my journalist days with the who, what, where, why, when. But why? Why do we need to think about protein and know how much of it we're getting in our diets?
So the easiest answer I can tell you is you die without it.
Seems like a pretty good reason to eat protein.
Yes, which is also why I often tell people that if you want to be harder to kill, you need to make sure that you know how much protein you need and you're eating enough protein.
Because that converts directly into how much muscle you're able to maintain, and muscle makes you hard to kill too.
Yes, because all of your enzymes, all of your cell transporters, all of your blood transporters, all of your cell scaffolding, and the entire structure of your body, 100% of your hair, your fingernails, and much of your muscle, bone, and internal organs, including how you make hormones, is from protein.
I heard practically everything.
Yes. Protein makes our bodies run.
So
we are basically protein. No.
You're stardust.
Kinda. You know,
all those jokes about what we are, yeah. Including, I don't know if you've ever seen that article about someone did an actual breakdown of, we are all so much mineral. We even have gold and we do have stardust from like space stuff. They would say how much the value of the human body was because they broke down all of the minerals.
That's so fun. Okay, I hadn't seen this, but that is so fun.
Because it's like, okay, if you are decomposed and everything goes in the soil, how much are you worth? And I actually don't remember off the top of my head. I will look that up and report that back to you at the end of the podcast.
That's another conversation we actually do need
to have.
How
much you're worth?
Well, minerals in the body. And, right now that's a hot topic and I think a needed one. But there's also a lot of confusing information about minerals and electrolytes and that whole piece of things.
So we'll definitely do the mineral conversation. But okay, so we're practically made up of protein. We really, really need it to do all the good things, including things like hair and fingernails. I don't think people understand that those are made out of protein. And when you're struggling with your hair and you're struggling with your fingernails, often protein deficiency can be at play. And I just don't think we link it up to
how much
protein we're eating.
Yes. Yeah. So if someone's coming and complaining about that they've lost a lot of hair, their nails are really brittle, you know, culturally, I think around that topic, many people are just taught to be like, oh, it could be your thyroid. But that's actually not the first place you should look. It's legitimately how much protein is in your diet and are you getting enough of it? Because hair and fingernails are non-essential to you living. So when you are not getting enough protein, because right as we already mentioned, you are protein. You are fundamentally mostly made up of protein, which is why if you go to a deserted island, you get trapped on a deserted island, nothing reveals the holes within the whole vegan argument and the plant-based argument than getting stranded on a desert island.
Or watching people play Survivor.
Yes. You fall apart so quickly. Well, you fall apart and then you die.
You're watching them have like heart palpitations and get dizzy and then the bug bites can't heal and you can just see the malnourishment.
You just cannot eat enough leaves to keep your body running. The only way that that is possible in our Western society is because you are buffering it with a ton of calories from carbs and fat from other sources.
Or from refined protein sources.
Yes.
That you'll never find on a desert island.
That you do not find in a deserted island. No.
Okay. So we need the protein. The next question, though, is how much we need. And I think this is where the noise and the silence really starts to show up. The noisy side of how much we need, and then the silent side of how much we need.
Yes. So the standard you are going to see in basically a lot of just generalized blogs, articles, even just generalized information that you're getting on, you know, say like NPR or a standard podcast, they're going to tell you that the RDA for protein is 0.8 grams per kilogram. And so basically an example would be if you're a 150-pound person, that would work out to be about 54 grams of protein a day based on that calculation. So the 0.8 grams per kilogram. But what that generally works out to be is about 10% of your daily calories. So about 10% of your diet from a calculation like that is going to be from protein. However, the big
silent part
within this is the RDAs were originally developed as a way to just simply prevent malnutrition. So it represents the minimum amount of a specific nutrient that you need to not die. So and or quote unquote not get sick. And there's even variance within that based on specific disease states. But it's based on how I try and describe it to clients is just visualize yourself hanging over the edge of a cliff, and the RDAs are your fingernails
keeping you from
gripping into the ground and keeping you hanging over that cliff while you hope that someone can run fast enough to rescue you before your fingernails break.
So that sounds terrible.
It's dramatic. I make it dramatic on purpose because the conversation around protein is so noisy that I mostly encounter people who are afraid to eat protein than the opposite, which is they're getting enough protein in their diet.
And if you think about that, that's why it's so frustrating why we're having this conversation, because just hanging on the edge of the cliff is such a different feeling in your body than feeling like you feel awesome.
Yes. Another way I would say it is, you're not dead, but you are not awesome. So that's what that calculation is based on. It's, yay, you didn't die, right? We're keeping you going. We're going on the bare minimum here. But that calculation is not based on, I am showing up. I am loving my life. I have unlimited amounts of energy. My hair is full and luscious, and my nails don't break with every little thing that I do to them. Oh, and if I need to get up in the middle of the night at 3 o'clock in the morning and go pick up someone from the side of the road, I am not wrecked the next day because I am legitimately a thriving individual.
Which is a completely different life that you're living.
That is not the average individual we are encountering on a daily basis.
So you're all underselling protein.
Beyond.
And its impact in making us feel good. Because I, with the exception of disease states, which exist. So you could be listening to this podcast and it doesn't apply to you because you have kidney disease or something going on where protein is a different conversation for you. But beyond those exceptions, I've never seen anyone not start feeling markedly better if they start paying attention to their protein and stop missing more days than not with how much they're eating and start getting more. I see it in their workouts. I see it in the energy they can bring to their workouts. If they have actually had enough protein before they arrive to me, it is staggering how much more we get done in a session.
Just what your body becomes capable of. And I think the hard part within this conversation is if you've never experienced thriving from food, right? Many people are used to feeling not that great. And so the concept of feeling amazing and having food be a part of that equation, it's a foreign concept. Because if your status quo, even from a very young age, is just feeling generally okay, and you equate that to what feeling good is supposed to be, then it can be kind of a harder sell to understand if you just add more of this in, how you start to feel as it compounds and your body is able to catch up on doing enzymatic processes that it hasn't been able to do because it does not have enough amino acids available to it. It can be slightly overwhelming. It can be also very disappointing when you realize, oh my goodness, I could have been living this way for such a long time and I haven't been.
Yeah.
Because suddenly you're able to do the things that you want to do and you're not just talking about the things that you want to do. But within this conversation, how this changes and gets a little confusing for people is, again, that 0.8 gram per kilogram that is legitimately just a disease prevention, bare minimum of malnutrition, and for sedentary people. So people who do not move or are mostly sitting and not doing a lot. And so that continues to change no matter what within a healthy population based on how old are you? What is your gender? How active are you every day? What activities are you doing? And based on many of these factors, including your total energy intake, even from food, this protein equation is going to change because you need more, because you are doing more, or you're capable of burning more. And then the part that this gets really confusing is that as more and more research comes out around protein, we're even figuring out that during specific age groups, that old standard that we had, which was underutilizing and underfeeding, especially in the older age group of people, we have been statistically underfeeding them protein. And a really good study just came out recently about women who have gone through menopause and are over the age of 65. A recent study just found that it looks like for females over the age of 65 to prevent muscle loss, to prevent osteoporosis, and to limit disease.
And probably just frailty in general.
Just frailty in general, that they should be eating most likely 2.0 grams of protein per kilogram.
You guys, that means you're being shorted over 50%.
Yes.
50%.
And this, from my perspective, this is also a factor of if you don't know how much protein you should be eating and you have been under eating it for forever and then you go into menopause, from my perspective, this is a major factor for what drives up the production of belly fat, but also because you're already going into a state where you're losing a lot of muscle, you're losing a lot of bone, then it's just setting you up to be the person that says menopause was hell.
Yeah, you really struggle.
It's going to make you struggle a lot.
Yeah, that's a fascinating study. I mean, that's just completely exactly the opposite. Because we kind of undersell protein. We're like, well, just make sure you get to your 0.8 grams per person. That's very different from saying, you know, if you want to feel great as an elderly woman, which I think we sell this population short all the time anyway.
Yes.
Thank God they did the research on them. And say, you know what? We think it's more like 2.0. It could be just life-changing in how you feel if you bump that protein up. Okay, so we've kind of looked at, you know, what protein is, why we need it, and some of those general numbers of baseline looking at it. And I just don't think people know that this is the keeps you alive number and not the makes you feel awesome number. So Here's the thing, the chatter and the noise out there, then as soon as you're crossing over that 10% of your diet being for protein, you're climbing into the territory of what they would call high protein diet.
Yes.
And I think a lot of the headlines and a lot of the reporting around high protein diets are the ones that are more fear-based and the ones that can come with more questions for people to consider them. So first, what is a high protein diet? And then what do we need to know about it in order to make the choice for what feels right?
Yes. So to be clear, there's not a standardized definition for a high protein diet.
Everyone has their own definition.
Kind of. But the of general, mostly recognized agreement for saying something is high protein is making the diet around 25% protein. So that's the general recognized definition of a high protein diet, if 25% of your diet is made up of protein. But there's no standardized nor identified level of a high protein diet, nor a level that has been found to be dangerous. So that's a part of the silent part that I think gets lost, is that we actually haven't found an upper limit that's proved to be detrimental.
Like, and truly proved to be detrimental. I do know, like, as you're listening to this, there was a headline in the New York Post that said high protein diets can give you heart disease or damage you. And it was a salacious headline. But I showed it to Jen right away. And she's like, let me see the details. And it was like 14 people drinking a Boost Plus shake that had added canola oil and sugar and milk, dry milk powder and other things where you're like, this is going to be a shock to the body. And no one with a sane brain thinks that this is a win. And it was one day only. So it's a garbage study. I'll leave it at that. A lot of things on high protein are either coming with an angle or incomplete. And we really don't have any definitive research to say one way or the other.
No, but generally what is recognized is that you can safely go up to protein being about 35% of your diet, and there has been no research that has found that to be a problem within a healthy population.
Mm-hmm. And this is one of those things where I think if you start paying attention and testing, you can start finding the level where you feel awesome.
Yes. And I think since we're already been talking about, you know, 0.8 grams per kilogram, kind of establishing that is the bare minimum, what range you're looking for within someone who is moving, who is older, who is pretty active, they are not sedentary, you're looking at a range from anywhere from like 1.0. You can go all the way up to technically 4.4 grams per kilogram. And again, studies have not showed that going that high is a problem. But what I would say in general for the average person and the average female, we are talking about you figuring out if where you need to be on the spectrum of anywhere from 1.0 to 2.0 grams per kilogram. And I would say that since protein is such an important macronutrient for long-term health, actually working with someone who's going to identify all of the areas where your body is going to be utilizing more protein or needing more protein and legitimately getting a grams recommendation for your unique activity level and body and disease state, et cetera, to me, that is one of the best investments you can do.
Yeah, long-term investment, since we are protein, as we established in the beginning. So for all the noise out there for people saying a high protein diet is going to cause kidney damage, it's going to cause liver damage, it's going to cause osteoporosis, when we actually know it probably helps prevent it, what do you say to them?
Well, the first one, the kidney one, that gets really misunderstood because there's a major difference between someone who has poorly functioning kidneys, where you absolutely do need to be on a lower protein diet.
A managed amount.
A managed amount. And I would even argue that many people with kidney dysfunction are getting too low of protein recommendations, where an overcorrection happens. And then that low protein actually contributes to other issues within their health. But that's a whole other podcast. But within that, many people are confused with, If you already have poorly functioning kidneys, protein is something that you need to take a look at. But there's a big difference between avoiding protein because your kidneys are already damaged and protein actively damaging healthy kidneys. And a simple way of explaining that would be the differences between jogging with a broken leg and jogging with a perfectly healthy leg. Eating more protein does not increase how much your kidneys have to work, where some people make that claim. That has not been proven. Again, that is only true within a population of people who already have damaged kidneys, not healthy kidneys. So the verdict within that is there is absolutely no evidence that a high protein diet causes kidney damage in healthy adults. That has never been proven. Someone claiming that is making a false claim.
They're usually just extending out some.
They're taking one obscure study that has been completely debunked at this point within the medical community and claiming that this is
true
and it's not.
Okay, that's really good to know. So what about the other common claims like liver damage or osteoporosis?
It's the same deal as with kidneys. If you have liver damage, something like cirrhosis, then you are going to be told to eat less protein. But again, what is less? And that's going to be individualized to where they are within the disease state and what other factors are going on. The bottom line is if you have a healthy liver, a high protein diet does not cause liver damage.
Yeah, big difference.
There is a big difference.
And then what about with osteoporosis?
So people get confused about this. And there is some evidence that shows that if you just eat a lot of protein, you are going to increase the amount of calcium that you lose in your pee. But within that, that doesn't mean that eating more protein is going to cause osteoporosis, right? It's two different things. But also within this conversation, if you are eating a balanced diet that includes fruits and vegetables,
you're getting calcium.
Well, not only are you getting calcium, but you're going to decrease the amount of calcium that you pee out. Right,
so it's kind of like sponges.
Yeah, so it minimizes that phenomenon that happens.
And I actually find too on the osteoporosis conversation, people who do not get enough protein almost always struggle with maintaining muscle mass. And muscle mass pulling on your bones is one of the absolute best ways that you can maintain strong bones, because that tension is forever giving the signal to your body to have the bone be strong. And if you're not eating enough protein and losing your muscle mass, you're actually then inviting osteoporosis because you don't have enough muscle mass pulling on your bones.
Well, to build on that, that is also true then with bone and with protein. So you are actually more likely to end up with osteoporosis with a low protein diet, because what gets left out of this conversation is that bone is made up of protein.
Oh, because as we established in the beginning, we are protein.
We are
amino acids.
No, but truly though, we are protein. And from my perspective, this is one of the factors why women end up with osteoporosis more often and more likely. Yeah, there's several factors, but in general, women are terrible at eating protein as opposed to guys. And so it's just another way that we're going to lose more bone because we're not eating enough protein.
And what I always like to say is you have to eat the protein for your bone, but then when you pair it up with actual strength training or resistance training and you're intentional about both, then you're really in the winning category and can feel better about how your body's functioning. It's a great 1-2 punch.
It's an excellent combo, for sure. And if you have been diagnosed with osteoporosis, making sure you're not only looking at your calcium intake, which is often what gets focused on with osteoporosis, but this protein part of the conversation is also important, along with what you mentioned, which is the resistance training. Because I feel like most people do not get told that, you know, you need more protein, you need enough protein. But then also, if you want to build bone, you want to create strong bone and try and work against the osteoporosis progressing, this is a part of it, along with that resistance training that's going to help to build up the bone from, you know, the weight.
Yeah. Great 1-2 punch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So one other big noisy comment I want to address also is high protein diets in cancer or protein causing cancer.
There's no conclusive human studies that shows one way or the other if protein causes cancer or a high protein diet and its role in it. There are studies that have asked people, you know, how much protein they've ate over a lifetime and looked at how often they got cancer. And that research shows a connection between protein intake and cancer rates.
It's not causation.
It's not causation. And you know my feelings on any time I open a study and it's a questionnaire.
Yeah, it's instantly trash because people are so wildly inaccurate at recalling what they've eaten for food. They can't even manage a 5-day recall most of the time accurately, let alone something that would conclusively provide evidence of how much protein they ate over the course of their life and if it did or did not cause cancer, which, again, if you're eating enough protein, you're probably...
The human memory is completely inaccurate, and we know studies based on questionnaires are mostly inaccurate. Like, that's known within the research community, but you'll use them to try and start to prove the hypothesis or prove if that's the direction you should go. On top of that, I forget what the error rate is. It's pretty staggering, but all I need is my own master's experience using questionnaires, including we had to help each other give out, depending on the person in your group and your advisor, you'd be helping with other people's studies. So you'd be helping them give out questionnaires. And even mine involved a questionnaire. And I will never forget, again, we had access to college students. So a lot of studies are based on college students because you're using them to do these things because you bribe them and go, hey, do you want extra credit? Do you want to pass this class? Fill out these questionnaires and let's pretend that you actually care about the barriers to exercise. First of all, they don't. And then secondly, watching college students. I realized in that moment that everything that I believed about research was not true because I watched people literally take the sheet and then they would take their pen and they would circle all A's and then go to the next page, just circle all B's. The next page, circle all C's. And I will never forget all of us talking and being like, wait a minute, how has no one talked about the fact that if you're witnessing people literally not even reading the questions on your questionnaires, not even computing what the question was whatsoever, they're just literally just circling the same thing all the way down each row until the next page. And then
how is it even remotely accurate?
No, and I definitely had a crisis of ethics. I was just like, I already know that most of this data is debunked based on watching these people fill out these questionnaires. And my advisor legitimately was, this is just how it is.
Done.
This is just how it is. And so we're not going to lose any sleep about that. I'm like, well, you're not, but I'm definitely losing sleep about this.
Yeah.
Because, again, it flipped research and how I see research. I'm like, if this is happening with questionnaires, I fully understand what's happening with petri dishes. I'm fully understanding what's happening with solutions that we're concocting and we're making. I understood in that moment that there is so many things happening that you're not supposed to talk about. You're just not supposed to talk about them.
Which then again really shows you until you start to see things like meta-analysis where it's multiple studies put together creating an average that's showing a correlation.
And that's why those are highly valued.
Yes, and that's why they're gold. They're not the only thing. And I don't want to get off. We should just do it. It's own podcast.
We need to
research.
Move on from this.
We need to move on from the research. But I highly question the headlines you see because for all you know, you are throwing away the very thing that's going to make you feel stable and healthy for a 14-person study where they ate the meal one freaking time. Back to the New York Post reference.
To summarize the cancer one, what I would say is this, and this is why it's a confusing conversation, is where you are getting the protein from, it does appear to matter. And so this is how we know nitrate-infused protein sources, because of the nitrate in there, that's what's actually contributing to
this connection with
cancer, right?
The nitrate.
And many people take those studies that find nitrate infused meat, you know, sausages, ham,
pepperoni.
And then they take that and make claims that that is also true with steak, eggs,
salmon,
dairy,
chicken.
And it is not, right? It's legitimately processed meat that has a cancer connection, and it's not even due to the meat part. It's due to adding in the nitrate that preserves that meat. So it's not even the meat, right? But then on top of that, also that what can contribute to it is how it's prepared. So we do know that if you char a steak to be covered in black, that charring effect does contribute to potentially making you more at risk for developing cancer. But again, how many people are charring their meat to black? And then what type of protein you're eating? So a grass-fed steak versus a hot dog. And this is also that extremely gray, messy part of the conversation that often gets left out completely, which is the people you are including in the study, what are their protein sources? What are they classifying as protein? What are they buying? And that is often not defined, especially in these questionnaire studies. It's just whatever protein you are buying and purchasing, we don't care. As long as you're checking this box, great. But there's no differentiating between what is your diet made of? Like, what type of protein is your diet made up of? And that is often left completely in the dark with many studies.
Yeah, which is so unfortunate because they're using those results then to sway people's choices.
The other piece of this that commonly gets misunderstood within the cancer conversation is kind of how we were talking about the kidney and liver, is there does seem to be an association with increasing tumor size, which makes sense because IGF-1 is in protein, which causes growth, right? It's how you grow muscle, and then it can grow tumor. And so if you have a tumor present in the body and you suddenly go on a high protein diet, that can potentially contribute to the growth of the tumor. But that doesn't mean that the protein caused cancer. And again, it's what often gets very convoluted and confusing in the conversation.
And then also you still have those chicken and egg conversations of like, are you going to beat cancer if you're not fueled and fed and energized? So
I think the main thing to take away is that there is no proof that is definitive that high protein diets cause cancer. There's no proof there. There's only some correlation between different things, and most of them, it's not cut and dry at all.
So the other big area we want to tackle is the conversation around protein sources. So animal protein sources versus plant-based protein sources. And this is something I did not know until we were in college and you were helping me out, was that when you look at the amount of protein in food, so you're going to start paying attention to how much protein you're getting in your diet, and you look and you see how much protein is in a steak, and then the plant-based people are like, oh, well, you can get protein from pumpkin seeds. And I think pumpkin seeds are one of the leading sources. If you look at a plant-based protein graph, pumpkin's going to be on top with like 29 grams or something like that.
Per 100 grams.
Looks amazing. It looks like it competes with steak and all the things. And then you realize that all plant-based numbers given to you are for 100 grams of food.
Yes. Yeah, you would have to eat a cup of pumpkin seeds to get 29 grams of protein.
And I can tell you that your future includes digestive distress and bloating. And it's just not disclosed. The numbers look great for plant-based protein until you start to understand that they're being reported in 100 grams.
Right. So another common one is the broccoli. And there's protein in vegetables. If you're eating normal amounts of vegetables, which the average American is, considering that only 10% of Americans are even eating the recommended amount of vegetables, people are not eating 10 cups of broccoli to get 10 grams of protein. It's not happening.
They're getting 1 gram.
They're getting potentially 1 gram, if that.
Yeah.
And it, besides the fact that you would never eat 10 cups of broccoli. I mean, you might do it once because you've read the graph, you did the conversion, say, and you're gung-ho, and then you will never do it again because I can predict your future, because the digestive distress that is going to come from 10 cups of broccoli.
Especially if you accidentally chose raw.
I cannot even imagine.
I'm sorry if you did, because that is just a rotten experience.
Well, yeah, that's the part that annoys me about it, is people are causing themselves digestive distress or health harm, because this is not being made clear to them, or the differences between the two and what you're getting versus not getting, very convoluted, very confusing.
But here's what's also not discussed then. So animal protein comes at a much more lower calorie expenditure to get that level of protein than 2 cups of lentils will.
Staggering. Correct? So on average, to meet 125 grams of protein using what we would call whole food plant-based proteins, this is becoming a little bit of a different conversation if you are someone who's going to be utilizing a lot of protein powders.
And processed protein.
And processed protein. Or if you're including like a soy protein, like tempeh or tofu. That's where you can really gain a lot of protein that is similar to animal protein. But for the camp that's like, you should be choosing real whole foods, it should be lentils, it should be beans, it should be pumpkin seeds, it should be nuts. For you to get 125 grams of protein, you are going to eat on average about 400 to 800 more calories than someone who's getting their protein from an animal-based diet.
Which is massive if you're someone who hasn't really ever cared about what you're eating and now you are trying. It's going to put
you in just
an insane weight gain trajectory.
Yes. And digestive distress.
And it's very hard to create like activity levels and different things that would ever offset that.
Yeah, from my perspective, a lot of times individuals that I am working with that have gone on a plant-based diet, and they're often coming to me with a lot of chronic health issues. So they have gut issues, they have hormone issues, they have acne, they're fatigued, they cannot sleep, and they are fully in what we would call a malnourished state. And it is because of this confusion, because a normal person is not going to eat 2 cups of lentils. You're not naturally going to do that. And you're not looking at these charts, understanding that that 30 grams of protein that was based on 100 grams is actually converting to 2 cups of lentils. You're an average person. You're going to eat a half a cup of lentils. We can be ultra generous and say maybe you ventured out to a cup, but the average person is going to stop at around a cup of beans or lentils, anything in that category. You're not going to move past that unless you were raised in that type of environment where you're eating that many of that type of food. And again, your digestion would be prepared for it and you'd be fine. But that's not the standard for someone who's suddenly like, oh, I heard about plant-based, I should do this. They're not naturally going to eat enough protein when they remove animal products and then they bring plant proteins in. And this is, from my perspective, one of the number one things that really starts to hit people hard when they're about 2 to 3 years into being quote unquote plant-based.
Yeah. And we use this metaphor for a few different things about the body and health. But when you have a palace that has a vault inside of it and it's full of gold and rubies and diamonds and valuable things that keep a kingdom thriving, and that's your body's nutrient stores. Like what is in your bones, what is in your tissues, and what it has available to it, and the food you're bringing in. And then when you do either a crash diet, is where we use the example a lot, or in this case, go plant-based instead of animal-based, you are relying on what's in the vault when you stop like bringing in tribute, if it's really a palace and a kingdom. There's no new animal protein nutrients coming in as tribute. And so for a long time, you may feel okay if that vault started full because you,
yes,
how you ate as a child or college or whatever. But then when that vault is empty and there's just a ruby sparkling in the corner, you start to have health problems. And
what I think gets lost in translation is you can't just remove foods and then replace them with haphazard things and expect that to go well. But I do think that's the common belief around quote unquote going vegan or plant-based or vegetarian, whatever you want to call it, is that there's no harm that can happen. Just eat whatever. And somehow that got lost in the wind. A lot of harm can happen, like significant harm can happen if you are not doing it right, including getting extreme nutrient deficiencies that can cause long-term harm to your health. And I think that has gotten a little bit too wishy-washy as far as communicating that piece of it. Because if someone comes to me and they just legitimately are like, ethically, I can't eat animal proteins, I'm like, that's great. But are you willing to make this your full-time job until you fully understand how to fuel yourself? Because that is absolutely what you need to do. And two, you can't be afraid to eat certain things or your health will fail within this endeavor. If you're afraid of soy, if you're afraid of wheat, if you are afraid of a lot of the common foods that are going to really help you be able to transition and do this diet well, there's not a lot of places you can go there and look at them and say, oh yeah, you're going to thrive. You're going to do well.
I think as we round the turn here for home, the important things we want to talk about with protein is its role in building muscle and losing fat, which are both really important things. So what does a woman need to know about protein's role in those two things?
In order for you to build back the muscle stronger that you tore down with your resistance training session, you need enough protein in order for that rebuild process to happen.
I always tell my clients, if they work hard and do the resistance training and they make the time and they show up for that, it's like they made the time to hire the construction crew to build muscle in their body. But if they don't have the protein and they don't eat it, it's like they're waiting around those construction workers and they don't have the lumber and they don't have the nails and they don't have the hammers and they can't build. So it's a two-part process. You did the hard work of hiring the crew to make the additions in your body. You also have to give it the raw materials it needs to build the muscle.
Yeah. So how I would explain just a simple way to know if you have enough protein in your diet is, say you are starting to lift because you're understanding the importance of resistance training and lifting heavy, but you're mostly still doing it for the fact that you want to look quote unquote toned. And if you are not achieving changing what the external looks like, if you're never looking quote unquote more toned, that means that you are not gaining the muscle that you should be gaining if you are doing a progressive overload program that's actually meant to build you muscle. That is a red flag for two things. Either one, you are just under eating calories, or two, you are under eating protein. Yes, some people are going to build slower sometimes than other people, and it's harder for them. I would put myself in that category. But if you're never making forward progress where it's just chronically, I just don't build muscle, I can't get muscle, then these two factors do need to be looked at, because in general, even if you are in the slower, tougher category, it's still something that absolutely should and can be happening. It just means that then there's a little bit of math equations that need to be worked out if you're just chronically going, nothing works.
That, and I would add on to that, if you're also chronically really, really sore and you have a lot of breakdown after your workouts and they're reasonable.
So DOMS, if you're someone who deals with that.
DOMS is delayed onset muscle soreness, if you haven't heard of it.
That is a red flag also for either one being under fueled or under proteined.
Yeah.
So that is more likely in both of those situations.
Okay. So then what about protein for losing fat?
So the thing about protein and why it's such a rock star, if you are putting yourself in a couple of categories, I would say it's really important for weight maintenance and it's really important for losing fat. And how some people think about losing fat, they will call it weight loss. We like to focus on saying fat loss because we don't want you just losing random weight that could be muscle or bone or essential pieces of you that really, really matter. But within that, so that we're all on the same page, fat loss, weight loss. If you're putting yourself in that category, when you eat more protein, you will tend to feel full longer. It's a very satiating macronutrient. So carbs, fat is a little bit more satiating than carbohydrates. Carbohydrates are not satiating. You're going to keep eating them. I think we all know that carbs are very easy to keep eating, but protein actually stimulates the satiety hormones. What's satiety? Satiety means full. You want to stop eating. And so if you're someone that tends to say, you know what, I don't feel full after meals, even after eating, two factors to look at there. One, you want to eat your protein first, or at least half of your protein first.
Because it's so important to get it in.
Because it's kicking on that satiety hormone. It's getting it going, because then you might be someone who falls into the category where there's a little delayed onset there for that satiety to start hitting. And then two, you would want to look at how much you're eating, because often if someone is complaining of chronically being hungry despite quote unquote eating, then it usually means that there's some either under eating there or there's some imbalances going on with the plate that are going to make you hungry sooner than you should be. But besides that, protein actually makes your body work. It actually burns calories for you because protein does require energy. So your body has to work to break it down. So if you eat, say, 100 calories of protein, you'll only use about 70 calories of it because of what's called the thermic effect of food.
So it takes about 30 calories to break it down and get it into those amino acids that your body can use.
And so if you want quote-unquote free calorie burning, this is another reason why you want to make sure you have optimal amounts of protein in your diet, because it's actually going to help you burn calories. And then last but not least, protein helps you preserve muscle. It helps you prevent, you know, being in a calorie deficit, and that energy that you're burning, it helps to prevent that energy being burned coming from muscle, bone, and things that we don't want to be broken down. We want to lose fat. We don't want to be losing these important parts. And so when you have optimal protein, you're less likely to break down sources of you that we don't want being taken away and instead actually be burning fat.
I think that's a game changer to know. And it really, again, helps get the most out of, even if you add exercising to that, then you're really protecting the muscle and getting to chase fat loss and body recomposition a little bit more. So let's sum it up. Like, what are your final thoughts on protein for someone who knows they want to start incorporating more of it and they want to be more intentional about it? What are their first steps?
The first easy step is to look down at your hand, look at your palm, and you want to try and start including that much protein at your meals, the size of your palm. That's an easy way to do it. Or another easy way to think about it is, if you understand fully what protein sources are, most likely you just need to simply double the amount of protein that you're currently putting on your plate. And then include different kinds of proteins. You want to get different nutrients. You want to get different amino acids. So bring some variety in, mix it up. And, you know, we were giving plant proteins a hard time, but those beans are good for you.
They are.
So you do want to be including plant-based protein sources. And then if you are over 65, in general, you want to be eating more protein. And because it really helps to slow down age-related muscle loss, it improves your long-term health and quality of life. And then last but not least, if you are choosing to be plant-based or vegetarian or vegan, plan your meals carefully. Take the time to know where your protein is coming from, making sure that you have enough of it, but also understand the concept of you do not absorb 100% of what you are putting on your plate. Mm-hmm. And that is a big gap and hole that I see so many people who think they're putting enough, or they think they're getting enough protein, but you're actually not, because you have to eat more than you think you do because you're not absorbing all of it, and especially not with plant-based sources. And then lastly, don't get overwhelmed with it, right? You don't have to go from, okay, I'm understanding that I might be eating too little, to then going, oh, I have to be eating optimal amounts by tomorrow. That's setting you up for an unrealistic expectation. You have the time to learn and figure out how much you need to be putting on your plate. Because if you give yourself that time to do it right and to really learn how to put a good amount of protein for you and your unique needs on your plate, that's something that will take care of you for a lifetime. So this is worth your time and energy, but it's also worth you making sure that where you are getting your protein information from, that you believe it's, one, a reputable source, but also a helpful source that's helping you optimize your health and not just help you hang on by your fingernails over that cliff, because you deserve to have energy. We want you to be running around and feeling like you can take on the world, and protein is a major factor for being able to do that.
Thank you so much for joining us for this critical conversation about protein. I know we got a little bit spicy at times because we're pretty passionate about protein, but hopefully you're able to feel empowered and equipped to start thinking about protein differently, getting past the noise, and then understanding some of the silent parts that aren't discussed as much. You can go to our website, just click on the podcast page in order to get the download for protein. And then if you have follow-up questions, let us know. We are here to keep this conversation going with you so that you feel like you know everything you need to know about protein and using it and being empowered to take care of yourself with how you're eating protein. If someone came to mind while you were listening to this episode, share the episode with them. Help spread the message and give them empowering information about protein as well. And lastly, you hear it all the time at the end of a podcast, people asking for reviews or for you to share it, but it really is the only way that the word gets out there. And when you do, we see it and we do a happy dance. But more importantly, it helps spread the message of critical thinking around health and wellness. It means the world to us, and it could mean the world to someone else who hears the message as well. Until next time, be kind to yourself in the process of change.